Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is John W. Dean. Dean served as legal counsel for President Richard Nixon from 1970 to 73 and became a key witness against Nixon during the Watergate scandal. He also served as an associate deputy attorney general to the Department of Justice. He chronicled his White House experiences with a focus on Watergate in two memoirs, Blind Ambition and Lost Honor. This year, puzzled and concerned about the direction conservatism has gone in this country, especially in the last 12 years, he released Conservatives Without Conscience, published by Viking Press, and this is what we'll be discussing this evening. I'm talking to John Dean from his office in Beverly Hills, California. John Dean, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you being on the show.
My pleasure.
Conservatives Without Conscience is obviously a variation on Senator Barry Goldwater's 1960 classic, The Conscience of a Conservative. So let's begin with a definition of what conservatism actually meant when it took the stage in the early 1950s.
Tough question. As you know, I spent a whole chapter explaining to conservatives and liberals and moderates what conservatism is. I guess the simplest definition, because a lot of conservatives claim you cannot define conservatism. Conservatism, that it's an attitude, it's an approach, an outlook. But I think Barry Goldwater had as good a description and definition of it as anybody. He said it's drawing from the wisdom of the past and applying it to the present. And in the context of the government, where the government has a responsibility for providing security to the people, you always consider the freedom of the people when weighing that and always tilt the scale between freedom and security in terms of freedom.
That sounds good to me. Now,
it does to most everybody who pauses to think about it.
Exactly. But you describe how the postmodern period of conservatism began around 1994. To tell us what alarm bells were going off for you during that moment.
Well, really, it goes back to the genesis of this book, which was a conversation I had with the late senator who had known all my life. His son and I were roommates once in prep school, and we're still friends to this day. We talk almost weekly, if not daily, sometimes. And I was talking to the senator after the 94 victory by the Republicans when they took over the Congress. And in the course of the conversation, he was saying how he didn't understand where all the incivility that had become so standard in conservative politics had come from. He just said it just had nothing to do with conservatism, but he found it offensive. And he also said, I don't understand why the religious right is starting to run the Republican Party. And he was very worried about that. So really, this whole project started based on that conversation with a senator, but for the fact that his health was not very good. And at that time, I decided, well, I would put the project we were going to do together on the shelf until he was feeling better. That didn't happen. But in the course of our conversations, he at one point said, John, he said, I think conservatives have lost their conscience. I said, Senator, that's a great idea for a title.
It's an absolutely superb title. It says everything. But let's talk a little bit about today's conservative leaders. They seem to define themselves by what they oppose.
They do. What holds conservatism together today seems what I describe as the power of negative thinking. They've needed enemies. In fact, a lot of the early conflicts within conservatism were sort of brushed over by their being held together with their anti-communism in their early history. And the libertarians with the traditional conservatives found common cause, if you will, in their concern about communism. What evolved after that, as communism became a non-threat, was just the general concept of liberalism, just creating this great boogeyman, or actually it's more of a straw man, if you will, really.
Exactly.
And just poking at it and punching it and trying to, they pretty well accomplished their goal of making people even fearful of using or describing themselves as liberals, when in fact our entire government and our entire history is just classic liberalism.
Exactly. The Constitution absolutely is. Yeah.
You know, there's Senator Goldwater's granddaughter, Cece, did a documentary which just recently aired on HBO on the senator, called Mr. Conservative, and I think it's still airing. It may even air again. But Cece found some great footage of her grandfather back in 1963 when he was doing a press conference, and it was filmed. And he was asked something that provoked him to say that when history looks back on him and his politics and his philosophy, they won't call him a conservative. They'll call him a liberal.
Hmm.
And I think that's probably pretty true. He is certainly well left of center today.
Yeah, he is. He was especially a lot about cultural politics, it seemed to me.
Well, he just thought the government had no business involving itself in those issues.
Mm-hmm.
These were not things that the government had any business dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his classic liberalism, his libertarian streak, if you will.
Uh-huh. And so did the Republican Party actually lose you after 1994? I know you said you're no longer a Republican.
I've registered as an independent years ago. I don't actually remember which year I did, but I realized I'd actually never voted a straight ticket when I was in the White House. So I thought, well, it's just smart to register as an independent because that really reflects the kind of voting and thinking I have, where I don't think either party necessarily has captured all of the wisdom on how to govern.
That's a very good way of putting it. Now, you discussed extensively in your book the many characteristics of authoritarian personalities and so on, and certainly many of our leaders in Washington now take on those attributes. Talk to us a little bit more about that. It was fascinating.
Yeah, what happened is when the senator and I didn't do the book, he passed away, I didn't stop looking for answers, and it took me years to find the answers. Just say some very fundamental questions. You know, why are conservatives so nasty? You know, so many of them. And I was curious. And so I continued the pursuit until I found the answers in a body of science I didn't even know existed that began, it really formed in the aftermath of World War II when social scientists began looking for answers to the question of whether what had happened in Italy and Germany under Mussolini and Hitler could ever happen in the United States. Would Americans ever follow a dictator left so easily as happened in those instances? And the short answer was yes. They've discovered there are clearly what they described as an authoritarian personality that is very insecure, that has difficulty with the ambiguities of daily life, and finds great comfort and safety in adopting the worldview of an authoritarian personality or a religious belief or a political outlook, and it answers the questions for them. And once they do absorb this and adopt it, they're very uncritical, and then they become very aggressive in their effort to push that worldview as the only answer to all the questions. And they're often very simplistic views. And as I say, these people are not self-critical at all. They can see only their side of the story, mm-hmm. and they don't want to hear anybody else talking about what other views might be. Ironically, we've now got about a half century of testing on this. It started based in Freudian psychology, but other social scientists realized very quickly that there are lots of questions and problems with Freudian psychology, so they turned to pure empirical research, where they began anonymous questioning through questionnaires that are highly integrated and refined and correlated over many, many uses, where today there are literally tens upon tens of thousands of people, including the leading expert I dealt with. He tested 1,500 state legislators here in the United States. And with this body of information that focused primarily on authoritarian followers, you find that the higher they test as authoritarian personalities, the more conservative they are in their politics. The ironic thing is you don't find the same on the left.
Mm-hmm.
While the experts tell me they believe there are authoritarian followers on the left, that they are so small statistically that they're not significant or worth studying. Because the bulk of them do fall on the right.
Hmm.
So this is hard science.
Yeah.
And when they go on and test these people for their other personality traits, they find they are nasty, they are bullies, they're prejudiced, they're mean-spirited people. And these are not labels that social scientists put on them. These are self-descriptive terms that these people come up with in describing, you know, when they respond to a statement, do you agree with this statement or disagree, and how much? These are the traits that come out.
Mm-hmm. And I was curious to hear said that also these people have no belief in equality.
That is correct. That is correct. That is particularly that is generally true with conservatives across the board, though.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a defining distinction between the conservative and the liberal, it is the whether they believe or accept equality. Conservatives have very little time for equality.
It has to do with their insecurity, perhaps.
Well, yes. Understand now, not all conservatives are authoritarians,
mm-hmm.
nor are all authoritarians conservative.
Right, yes.
But what we find is the core of the Republican Party today, the social conservatives and the neoconservatives, the social conservatives are typically, I mean, overwhelmingly authoritarian personalities, either followers or a few leaders, authoritarian leaders. The neoconservatives are interesting in that their philosophy and worldview is highly authoritarian, while they themselves are not necessarily authoritarian personalities.
Hmm.
They tend to be more social dominators or authoritarian leader types than follower types, but they have a very dogmatic philosophy that is highly authoritarian in its nature.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the neocons because they really believe that the U.S. should use its power to promote its values around the world, right? And use force if necessary. That's part of the philosophy.
They do. They have a very sort of a muscular Wilsonian, let's spread democracy around the globe at a gunpoint philosophy, and we know now that doesn't work too well. We've had a pretty good lab experiment a tragic lab experiment in Iraq, where you just can't suddenly remove a dictator and expect democracy to flourish. It just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, it was a naive experiment from the beginning, I have to say. Now you discussed quite extensively, this is a common concern among the people and activists I know, the rise of the conservative Christians. So talk to us a little bit about that. Where did their power come from? Why do they have so much influence?
Well, you know, it's interesting that they got the evangelical Christians, who are the core of the religious right today, did not start on the right. They were actually attracted to politics when Jimmy Carter ran. The history of it is, the evangelicals, after the 1925 Scopes trial, where they were embarrassed terribly about their failure to get evolution removed from the curriculum of Tennessee schools, they just sort of said, we've had it with politics, we'll just go on and live our own lives and stay out of that world. Well, their children, however, got interested in politics. And by the time Jimmy Carter is running as a born-again evangelical Christian,
I remember.
They get that attracts their attention, and they are very helpful in supporting his bid for the presidency. What happened, however, is they found once he was in, they didn't like his politics. He was too liberal for them, and therefore they indeed decided to work to get him out of the White House and became active in Ronald Reagan's campaign,
mm-hmm.
And helped get him in. They weren't totally satisfied with what Reagan gave them. He was good on the rhetoric, but didn't deliver much for them in terms of their social agenda. So they stayed to play, however, and really with Pat Robertson's bid for the presidency, he, in an organizational sense, really is one of the key people involved in the development of the religious right. While his policy, while his presidency and his bid was fatally doomed, he developed a Rolodex, so to speak, that wouldn't quit. And he taught people how to work at the state and local level as well, which was further developed after he had his unsuccessful bid. And that became the effort of the organizational plans of the religious right, is they became the worker bees, and they're now indispensable to the Republican Party because they do for the Republicans what labor used to do for the Democrats, is they get people out to the polls, they run the phone banks, they lick the envelopes and the stamps, if you will, and they're just they're a large army of tireless workers who, for example, we will see in the 06 election these people in action, because they're very central to the Republicans' 72-hour get-out-the-vote program. And notwithstanding what's happening with ex-Congressman Foley and the Republican leadership regarding the inappropriate emails to pages. And
oh, yes, the Foley thing, yeah.
Right. They're still hanging in there. Their leaders, for example, Dodson, is telling them, well, that's just all a joke, and it's Foley and nothing. Well, it's obviously much more than that, but they need to keep the troops, and they want power as badly as anybody else, so they'll play the game however they have to play it. And indeed, in their early days, they played some of the dirtiest politics we've ever had in America, notwithstanding their Christian beliefs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John W. Dean, and we're discussing his recent book, Conservatives Without Conscience. You know, John, I a lot of people wonder how these religious conservatives are getting away with doing political action and keeping their tax-free status. Did you have any comments about how they're able to accomplish this?
Well, they're getting people to look the other way in Washington, and no one is really policing them there. The New York Times has run very large stories on this that started on Sunday and again today, and it's really quite remarkable what they're getting away with under the tax laws.
Yeah, it is.
This is the Bush administration at work. They realize the importance of these people. This is the payoff. While they're not getting everything they want, they're not getting a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriages. They are getting grants and tax benefits that others are not.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you also suggest that it was the rise of Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay who set the stage for this authoritarian control that we're seeing now. To talk to us a little bit about that.
I discovered that was so apparent to me in Washington. I was back there during the Clinton impeachment, and I had actually started my career in Washington in the House, working for the House Judiciary Committee, and became the chief minority counsel of that committee. And so I know how the Congress works, and I was quite stunned after being away from Washington and the House for years, watching it in action during the Clinton impeachment. And I tracked it back to, indeed, 94, and we see a very dramatic change in the way the House operates. And this is where the authoritarianism first begins blossoming in Washington. And it's with this very sort of monocratic, almost dictatorial rule of the House Republicans and their leadership, where no longer did seniority count for anything. Rather, it was whether that you would get it to be a chairman of a committee if you could raise enough money for the Republicans and put it in their coffers and do what the special interests wanted, including let them come in and often write legislation. They have, for all practical purposes, just pretend like the Democrats are not even there.
Yeah, I realize that. Yep.
A very good example of that is this whole Foley thing, where members of the Page Oversight Committee, the Republicans were told about Foley's misbehavior. The Democrats were not, which is, you know, they just treat them as non-entities.
Mm-hmm.
They don't let them, write legislation. They freeze them out from making amendments on the floor. And as I say, it's really quite remarkable when one scratches the surface and sees how dictatorial their rule is. And it's really continued right on right through Hastert. Now, I don't think he is as strong as some of his lieutenants, but the caucus itself is set up that way, and they're going to play the game that way. Hopefully, if the Democrats do get control, they don't play the same game.
Yeah, people are worried about that, yeah. I know your book isn't totally about the current administration, and you're not very flattering to our current crop of Republican leaders. You say the House Republicans have gone beyond raising money from well-heeled conservative sources, that they have, in effect, rigged the system. Tell us more about that.
Well, we'll get the real test of how far they've gone. You know, today you can't call this election, notwithstanding the widespread public disenchantment with Bush and the war in Iraq and the disenchantment with Congress, where it's getting some of the lowest numbers we've seen in decades for Congress and its ability to do the job. They spent very diligent efforts and money on redistricting state after state after state where Republicans were in control, and several states, not as the typical redistricting is done and when the centennial census is taken, but they did it as soon as they got control of the state. The Supreme Court just recently ruled you can do that. Mm-hmm. So that may well cut against the Republicans because more Democrats are getting control states now, and indeed they can play the same game. But what the way the system is set up right now is it protects incumbency. So there are not many. It's really taken very dire circumstances to put the House and Senate in play, but they are.
Mm-hmm. They are indeed, absolutely.
What we'll see though is there are 4 weeks to go until the election. We haven't seen the Republicans unleash their negative campaign yet.
Exactly.
They spent, the National Committee spent roughly $20 million, I'm told, doing opposition research so that the candidates, their candidates in the various districts around the country have nothing to do with this, but the National Committee is going to come in and run negative ads where they found dug up any dirt or negative nuance they can find, and these are very effective.
Oh, they have been.
Exactly. And they plan to spend $60 million of ad money in the final weeks of the campaign.
Yeah, so we'll be seeing some swift voting again, right?
We will indeed.
We do expect that, yeah.
And we may well yet have an October surprise. I don't think the October surprise was Foley in the closet.
You are really not flattering about Dick Cheney. You say he's an imperial vice president and his trademark is bad judgment. Tell us more about that.
Well, I was delighted my friend Bob Woodward is beginning to realize what Dick Cheney's all about.
I was delighted about that, too.
Cheney called him up the other day and just swore a blue streak on him and hung up on him.
Really?
But that's Dick Cheney. That's Dick Cheney's style. He's not a very nice human being and could care less what people think of him, so he just does what he wants to do. I've watched Cheney for a number of years, and people, you know, give Cheney sort of an eminence that I think is misplaced. When you look at his actual careers, you go back and look at him as Rumsfeld's assistant at the OEO under Nixon. You look at him as Ford's chief of staff after Nixon's resignation. When you look at his career in Congress, you look at his presidential bid, you look at his tenure as Secretary of Defense, and you now look at him as vice president, it's a career that's capped by bad judgment every single step of the way.
I tend to agree with
which
you.
Which I do
that.
In the book, in some
way. You do. And you know what else you say? That this is very interesting to me. You said, and I quote, "It is abundantly clear that George Bush is a mental lightweight with a strong right-wing authoritarian personality." I found that very interesting. Most people say, I think Bush probably must be smarter than he seems," but you don't think
so?
Well,
I don't think he's dumb. I don't think he's dumb. I think he's ignorant, and I think there's a difference. He's ignorant because he has absolutely no interest or disposition or discipline to dig in and want to learn things he needs to learn. He's always been able to sort of glad hand his way along in life, and somebody else will come in and clean up his messes. So that's what he's doing pretty much as president. It's just exactly what he's done all of his adult life.
And do you agree with a lot of people who ascertain that he's really not in charge, that Dick Cheney really is the president?
I think Cheney's genius is that he lets Bush wake up every morning and think he's president.
that's classic. You say Cheney knows how to manipulate him, right, like a puppet. Where did you come up with that, though?
I've got very good sources, and I think Woodward's come to the same conclusion.
It's surprising.
He has even better sources than mine. Mine were just talking sooner than his.
Uh-huh. And what about the Bush administration's use of fear tactics? It feels like so many of us, like a Latin American dictatorship, the way they use the fear tactics to try to scare people.
That's the direct analogy I draw in the book. It shows this is exactly the way authoritarian dictators in third world countries operate, is they use fear. And you look at the way this administration has succeeded, and if they succeed in in this election, it will again be because of their fear-mongering. They were starting to crank it up before the Foley situation gave them a setback, but they've used it in every election since 9/11, where they have taken 9/11 and made it much more horrible, the potential of another 9/11, than it really is. There's no question that terrorism is a true threat, that we were ill-equipped and did not have our national security focused on it sufficiently, but that isn't the case anymore. But the threat is not as great as we faced during the Cold War years with the communists, who were infiltrating the country as well, who had the capability not just of one, maybe getting one or two nuclear weapons. They could have wiped us off the map. That's a serious threat. Yes, it would be a travesty to have a nuclear weapon, and that's the worst case that you could get with a terrorist, is maybe they could get one or two nuclear weapons, and that, even that is highly remote. But still, that isn't going to end the country, whereas communism could well have done so, because we had another very large country, then the USSR, now Russia, mm-hmm. With resources that match our own in wealth behind it. That could indeed, that was much more dangerous. But we didn't toss out the Bill of Rights when the communists were a threat.
That's right.
There were people who got carried away at times, like McCarthy, with the threat, and used fear-mongering for their political success. But it was seen pretty much for what it was, and they put that back in the box after a while. With Bush, they've just used this very subtle fear-mongering for every campaign. One of the interesting things I found in the science of the authoritarianism is, of course, because authoritarian followers are people who are generally fearful, that you drive more people into these ranks of being authoritarian followers by using fear.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things they have succeeded in doing. But I'm also somebody who happens to believe that the great majority of Americans are centrists. We're always have been a centrist country. We run best and govern best when we're going down the middle. And right now the debate is being set by the extremes. We're like a big bell curve, and they're sort of the lips of the curve are setting the agenda. And at some point, I think Americans are going to, that great majority that's out there will sit up and say, we've had enough. That may, if it doesn't happen in 06, hopefully it'll happen in 08.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what are your hopes for the midterms that are coming up in about 4 weeks? We just have about another minute left.
Well, the closest, Congressional Quarterly is, to me, the least partisan, most accurate, closest group that follows district by district, particularly in the House as well, and they follow state by state in the Senate. They can't call it right now, but it's certainly leaning that the Democrats are going to regain control, and that'll obviously influence 08. I'm just hopeful because I think we need some checks on this presidency and this administration.
I agree with you. John Dean, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you well for the future and the future of this country as well.
I thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.